sharpened wits, he was moved to answer, "No, sir." "Where do you come from?" "Kansas City, sir." "Any references?" "No, sir. I am just an unskilled man. I've got good arms." "I want men for hard work. It's all underground, digging tunnels for telephones. Maybe it won't suit you." "I'm willing, sir. Anything for me. What's the pay?" "$0.15 an hour." "I'm willing, sir." "All right, go back there and give your name." So within half an hour, he was at work, far underneath the streets of the city. The tunnel was a peculiar one for telephone wires. It was about 8 feet high, and with a level floor nearly as wide. It had innumerable branches, a perfect spider web beneath the city. Jurgis walked over half a mile with his gang to the place where they were to work. Stranger yet, the tunnel was lighted by electricity, and upon it was laid a double-tracked, narrow-gauge railroad. But Jurgis was not there to ask questions, and he did not give the matter a thought. It was nearly a year afterward that he finally learned the meaning of this whole affair. The city council had passed a quiet and innocent little bill allowing a company to construct telephone conduits under the city streets, and upon the strength of this, a great corporation had proceeded to tunnel all Chicago with a system of railway freight subways. In the city, there was a combination of employees representing hundreds of millions of capital and formed for the purpose of crushing the labor unions. The chief union which troubled it was the Teamsters. And when these freight tunnels were completed, connecting all the big factories and stores with the railroad depots, they would have the Teamsters Union by the throat. Now and then, there were rumors and murmurs in the board of aldermen, and once there was a committee to investigate. But each time, another small fortune was paid over, and the rumors died away, until at last the city woke up with a start to find the work completed. There was a tremendous scandal, of course. It was found that the city records had been falsified and other crimes committed, and some of Chicago's big capitalists got into jail, figuratively speaking. The aldermen declared that they had had no idea of it all, in spite of the fact that the main entrance to the work had been in the rear of the saloon of one of them. It was in a newly opened cut that Jurgis worked, and so he knew that he had an all-winter job. He was so rejoiced that he treated himself to a spree that night, and with the balance of his money, he hired himself a place in a tenement room, where he slept upon a big, homemade straw mattress, along with four other working men. This was $1 a week, and for four more, he got his food in a boarding house near his work. This would leave him $4 extra each week, an unthinkable sum for him. At the outset, he had to pay for his digging tools and also to buy a pair of heavy boots since his shoes were falling to pieces, and a flannel shirt since the one he had worn all summer was in shreds. He spent a week meditating whether or not he should also buy an overcoat. There was one belonging to a Hebrew collar-button peddler who had died in the room next to him, in which the landlady was holding for her rent. In the end, however, Jurgis decided to do without it, as he was to be underground by day and in bed at night. This was an unfortunate decision, however, for it drove him more quickly than ever into the saloons. From now on, Jurgis worked from 7 o'clock until 5:30, with half an hour for dinner, which meant that he never saw the sunlight on weekdays. In the evenings, there was no place for him to go except the bar room, no place where there was light and warmth, where he could hear a little music or sit with a companion and talk. He had now no home to go to. He had no affection left in his life. Only the pitiful mockery of it and the camaraderie of vice. On Sundays, the churches were open, but where was there a church in which an ill-smelling working man with vermin crawling upon his neck could sit without seeing people edge away and look annoyed? He had, of course, his corner, in a close though unheated room, with a window opening upon a blank wall 2 feet away, and also he had the bare streets, with the winter gales sweeping through them. Besides this, he had only the saloons, and of course, he had to drink to stay in them. If he drank now and then, he was free to make himself at home, to gamble with dice or a pack of greasy cards, to play at a dingy pool table for money, or to look at a beer-stained pink sporting paper with pictures of murderers and half-naked women. It was for such pleasures as these that he spent his money, and such was his life during the 6 weeks and a half that he toiled for the merchants of Chicago, to enable them, to break the grip of their Teamsters Union. In a work thus carried out, not much thought was given to the welfare of the laborers. On an average, the tunneling cost a life a day in several manglings. It was seldom, however, that more than a dozen or two men heard of any one accident. The work was all done by the new boring machinery, with as little blasting as possible, but there would be falling rocks and crushed supports and premature explosions, and in addition, all the dangers of railroading. So it was that one night, as Jurgis was on his way out with his gang, an engine in a loaded car dashed round one of the innumerable right-angle branches and struck him upon the shoulder, hurling him against the concrete wall and knocking him senseless. When he opened his eyes again, it was to the clanging of the bell of an ambulance. He was lying in it, covered by a blanket, and it was threading its way slowly through the holiday shopping crowds. They took him to the county hospital, where a young surgeon set his arm. Then he was washed and laid upon a bed in a ward with a score or two more of maimed and mangled men. Jurgis spent his Christmas in this hospital, and it was the pleasantest Christmas he had had in America. Every year there were scandals and investigations in this institution, the newspapers charging that doctors were allowed to try fantastic experiments upon the patients. But Jurgis knew nothing of this. His only complaint was that they used to feed him upon tinned meat, which no man who had ever worked in Packingtown would feed to his dog. Jurgis had often wondered just who ate the canned corned beef and roast beef of the stockyards. Now he began to understand that it was what you might call graft meat, put up to be sold to public officials and contractors, and eaten by soldiers and sailors, prisoners and inmates of institutions, shantymen and gangs of railroad laborers. Jurgis was ready to leave the hospital at the end of 2 weeks. This did not mean that his arm was strong and that he was able to go back to work, but simply that he could get along without further attention, and that his place was needed for someone worse off than he. That he was utterly helpless and had no means of keeping himself alive in the meantime was something which did not concern the hospital authorities, nor anyone else in the city. As it chanced, he had been hurt on a Monday and had just paid for his last week's board and his room rent and spent nearly all the balance of his Saturday's pay. He had less than 75 cents in his pockets and a dollar and a half due him for the day's work he had done before he was hurt. He might possibly have sued the company and got some damages for his injuries, but he did not know this, and it was not the company's business to tell him. He went and got his pay and his tools, which he left in a pawn shop for 50 cents. Then he went to his landlady, who had rented his place and had no other for him, and then to his boarding-house keeper, who looked him over and questioned him, as he must certainly be helpless for a couple of months, and had boarded there only 6 weeks. She decided very quickly that it would not be worth the risk to keep him on trust. So Jurgis went out into the streets in a most dreadful plight. It was bitterly cold, and a heavy snow was falling, beating into his face. He had no overcoat and no place to go, and $2.65 in his pocket, with the certainty that he could not earn another cent for months. The snow meant no chance to him now. He must walk along and see others shoveling, vigorous and active, and he with his left hand bound to his side. He could not hope to tide himself over by odd jobs of loading trucks. He could not even sell newspapers or carry satchels, because he was now at the mercy of any rival. Words could not paint the terror that came over him as he realized all this. He was like a wounded animal in the forest. He was forced to compete with his enemies upon unequal terms. There would be no consideration for him because of his weakness. It was no one's business to help him in such distress, to make the fight the least bit easier for him. Even if he took to begging, he would be at a disadvantage, for reasons which he was to discover in good time. In the beginning, he could not think of anything except getting out of the awful cold. He went into one of the saloons he had been wont to frequent and bought a drink, and then stood by the fire shivering and waiting to be ordered out. According to an unwritten law, the buying a drink included the privilege of loafing for just so long. Then one had to buy another drink or move on. The Jurgis was an old customer entitled him to a somewhat longer stop. But then, he had been away 2 weeks, and was evidently on the bum. He might plead and tell his hard luck story, but that would not help him much. A saloon keeper, who was to be moved by such means, would soon have his place jammed to the doors with hobos on a day like this. So Jurgis went out into another place and paid another nickel. He was so hungry this time that he could not resist the hot beef stew, an indulgence which cut short his stay by a considerable time. When he was again told to move on, he made his way to a tough place in the Levy district, where now and then he had gone with a certain rat-eyed bohemian working man of his acquaintance, seeking a woman. It was Jurgis's vain hope that here the proprietor would let him remain as a sitter. In low-class places in the dead of winter, saloon-keepers would often allow one or two forlorn-looking bums who came in covered with snow or soaked with rain to sit by the fire and look miserable to attract custom. A working man would come in, feeling cheerful after his day's work was over, and it would trouble him to have to take his glass with such a sight under his nose. And so he would call out, "Hello, Bob, what's the matter? You look as if you've been up against it." And then the other would begin to pour out some tale of misery, and the man would say, "Come on, have a glass. Maybe that'll brace you up." And so they would drink together. And if the tramp was sufficiently wretched-looking or good enough at the gab, they might have two. And if they were to discover that they were from the same country, or had lived in the same city, or worked at the same trade, they might sit down at a table and spend an hour or two and talk, and before they got through, the saloon-keeper would have taken in a dollar. All of this might seem diabolical, but the saloon-keeper was in no wise to blame for it. He was in the same plight as the manufacturer who has to adulterate and misrepresent his product. If he does not, someone else will. And the saloon-keeper, unless he is also an alderman, is apt to be in debt to the big brewers and on the verge of being sold out. The market for sitters was glutted that afternoon, however, and there was no place for Jurgis. In all, he had to spend 6 nickels in keeping a shelter over him that frightful day. And then it was just dark, and the station houses would not open until midnight. At the last place, however, there was a bartender who knew him and liked him and let him doze at one of the tables until the boss came back. And also, as he was going out, the man gave him a tip. On the next block, there was a religious revival of some sort with preaching and singing, and hundreds of hobos would go there for the shelter and warmth. Jurgis went straight away and saw a sign hung out saying that the door would open at 7:30. Then he walked or half ran a block and hid a while in a doorway, and then ran again, and so on until the hour. At the end, he was all but frozen and fought his way in with the rest of the throng, at the risk of having his arm broken again, and got close to the big stove. By 8 o'clock, the place was so crowded that the speakers ought to have been flattered. The aisles were filled halfway up, and at the door men were packed tight enough to walk upon. There were 3 elderly gentlemen in black upon the platform, and a young lady who played the piano in front. First they sang a hymn, and then one of the 3, a tall, smooth-shaven man, very thin and wearing black spectacles, began an address. Jurgis heard smatterings of it, for the reason that terror kept him awake. He knew that he snored abominably, and to have been put out just then would have been like a sentence of death to him. The evangelist was preaching sin and redemption, the infinite grace of God and his pardon for human frailty. He was very much in earnest, and he meant well, but Jurgis, as he listened, found his soul filled with hatred. What did he know about sin and suffering, with his smooth black coat and his neatly starched collar, his body warm and his belly full and money in his pocket, and lecturing men who were struggling for their lives, men at the death grapple with the demon powers of hunger and cold? This, of course, was unfair, but Jurgis felt that these men were out of touch with the life they discussed, that they were unfitted to solve its problems. Nay, they themselves were part of the problem. They were part of the order established that was crushing men down and beating them. They were of the triumphant and insolent possessors. They had a hall and a fire and food and clothing and money, and so they might preach to hungry men, and the men must be humble and listen. They were trying to save their souls. And who but a fool could fail to see that all that was the matter with their souls was that they had not been able to get a decent existence for their bodies. At 11, the meeting closed, and the desolate audience filed out into the snow, muttering curses upon the few traitors who had got repentance and gone upon the platform. It was yet another hour before the station house would open, and Jurgis had no overcoat and was weak from a long illness. During that hour, he nearly perished. He was obliged to run hard to keep his blood moving at all, and then he came back to the station house and found a crowd blocking the street before the door. This was in the month of January 1904, when the country was on the verge of hard times, and the newspapers were reporting the shutting down of factories every day. It was estimated that 1.5 million of men were thrown out of work before the spring, so all the hiding places of the city were crowded, and before that station house door, men fought and tore each other like savage beasts. When at last the place was jammed and they shut the doors, half the crowd was still outside, and Jurgis, with his helpless arm, was among them. There was no choice then but to go to a lodging house and spend another dime. It really broke his heart to do this at 12:30, after he had wasted the night at the meeting and on the street. He would be turned out of the lodging house promptly at 7. They had the shelves which served as bunks so contrived that they could be dropped, and as any man who was slow about obeying orders could be tumbled to the floor. This was one day, and the cold spell lasted for 14 of them. At the end of 6 days, every cent of Jurgis's money was gone, and then he went out onto the streets to beg for his life. He would begin as soon as the business of the city was moving. He would sally forth from saloon, and after making sure there was no policeman in sight, would approach every likely-looking person who passed him, telling his woeful story and pleading for a nickel or a dime. Then when he got one, he would dart around the corner and return to his base to get warm, and his victim, seeing him do this, would go away, vowing that he would never give a cent to a beggar again. The victim never paused to ask where else Jurgis could have gone under the circumstances, where he, the victim, would have gone. At the saloon, Jurgis could not only get more food and better food than he could buy in any restaurant for the same money, but a drink in the bargain to warm him up. Also, he could find a comfortable seat by a fire, and could chat with a companion until he was as warm as toast. At the saloon, too, he felt at home. Part of the saloon keeper's business was to offer a home and refreshments to beggars in exchange for the proceeds of their foragings. And was there anyone else in the whole city who would do this? Would the victim have done it himself? Poor Jurgis might have been expected to make a successful beggar. He was just out of the hospital and desperately sick-looking and with a helpless arm. Also, he had no overcoat and shivered pitifully. But alas, it was again the case of the honest merchant who finds that the genuine and unadulterated article is driven to the wall by the artistic counterfeit. Jurgis, as a beggar, was simply a blundering amateur in competition with organized and scientific professionalism. He was just out of the hospital, but the story was worn threadbare, and how could he prove it? He had his arm in a sling, and it was a device a regular beggar's little boy would have scorned. He was pale and shivering, but they were made up with cosmetics and had studied the art of chattering their teeth. As to his being without an overcoat, among them you would meet men you could swear had on nothing but a ragged linen duster and a pair of cotton trousers, so cleverly had they concealed the several suits of all-wool underwear beneath. Many of these professional mendicants had comfortable homes and families and thousands of dollars in the bank. Some of them had retired upon their earnings and gone into the business of fitting out and doctoring others, or working children at the trade. There were some who had both their arms bound tightly to their sides and padded stumps in their sleeves, and a sick child hired to carry a cup for them. There were some who had no legs and pushed themselves upon a wheeled platform. Some who had been favored with blindness and were led by pretty little dogs. Some less fortunate had mutilated themselves or burned themselves or had brought horrible sores upon themselves with chemicals. You might suddenly encounter upon the street a man holding out to you a finger rotting and discolored with gangrene, or one with livid scarlet wounds half escaped from their filthy bandages. These desperate ones were the dregs of the city's cesspools, wretches who hid at night in the rain-soaked cellars of old ramshackle tenements, in stale beer dives, in opium joints, with abandoned women in the last stages of the harlot's progress. Women who had been kept by Chinamen and turned away at last to die. Every day the police net would drag hundreds of them off the streets, and in the detention hospital you might see them herded together in a miniature inferno with hideous, beastly faces, bloated and leprous with disease, laughing, shouting, screaming in all stages of drunkenness, barking like dogs, gibbering like apes, raving and tearing themselves in delirium. Chapter 24. In the face of all his handicaps, Jurgis was obliged to make the price of a lodging, and of a drink every hour or two, under penalty of freezing to death. Day after day he roamed about in the Arctic cold, his soul filled full of bitterness and despair. He saw the world of civilization then more plainly than ever he had seen it before, a world in which nothing counted but brutal might, an order devised by those who possessed it for the subjugation of those who did not. He was one of the latter, and all outdoors, all life, was to him one colossal prison, which he paced like a pent-up tiger, trying one bar after another and finding them all beyond his power. He had lost in the fierce battle of greed, and so was doomed to be exterminated, and all society was busied to see that he did not escape the sentence. Everywhere that he turned were prison bars and hostile eyes following him, the well-fed, sleek policemen, from whose glances he shrank and who seemed to grip their clubs more tightly when they saw him, the saloon-keepers, who never ceased to watch him while he was in their places, who were jealous of every moment he lingered after he had paid his money, the hurrying throngs upon the streets, who were deaf to his entreaties, oblivious of his very existence, and savage and contemptuous when he forced himself upon them. They had their own affairs, and there was no place for him among them. There was no place for him anywhere. Every direction he turned his gaze, this fact was forced upon him. Everything was built to express it to him. The residences, with their heavy walls and bolted doors, and basement windows barred with iron, the great warehouses filled with the products of the whole world and guarded by iron shutters and heavy gates, the banks with their unthinkable billions of wealth, all buried in safes and vaults of steel. And then one day there befell Jurgis the one adventure of his life. It was late at night, and he had failed to get the price of a lodging. Snow was falling, and he had been out so long that he was covered with it, and was chilled to the bone. He was working among the theater crowds, flitting here and there, taking large chances with the police, in his desperation half hoping to be arrested. When he saw a blue coat start toward him, however, his heart failed him, and he dashed down a side street and fled a couple of blocks. When he stopped again, he saw a man coming toward him and placed himself in his path. "Please, sir," he began in his usual formula, "will you give me the price of a lodging? I've had a broken arm, and I can't work, and I've not a cent in my pocket. I'm an honest working man, sir, and I've never begged before. It's not my fault, sir." Jurgis usually went on until he was interrupted, but this man did not interrupt, and so at last he came to a breathless stop. The other had halted, and Jurgis suddenly noticed that he stood a little unsteadily. "Was that you say?" he queried suddenly in a thick voice. Jurgis began again, speaking more slowly and distinctly. Before he was half through, the other put out his hand and rested it upon his shoulder. "Poor old chappie," he said. "Been up against it, eh?" Then he lurched toward Jurgis, and the hand upon his shoulder became an arm about his neck. "Up against it myself, old sport," he said. "She's a hard old world." They were close to a lamppost, and Jurgis got a glimpse of the other. He was a young fellow, not much over 18, with a handsome boyish face. He wore a silk hat and a rich soft overcoat with a fur collar, and he smiled at Jurgis with benignant sympathy. "I'm hard up too, my good friend," he said. "I've got cruel parents, or I'd set you up. What's the matter with you?" "I've been in the hospital." "Hospital?" exclaimed the young man, still smiling sweetly. "That's too bad. Same's my Aunt Polly. My Aunt Polly's in the hospital, too. Oh, Auntie's been having twins. What's the matter with you?" "I've got a broken arm," Jurgis began. "So?" said the other sympathetically. "That ain't so bad. You get over that. I wish somebody'd break my arm, old chappy. Damn for don't. Then they'd treat me better. Hold me up, old sport. What do you want me to do? I'm hungry, sir, said Jurgis. Hungry? Why don't you have some supper? I've got no money, sir. No money? Ho ho, let's be chums, old boy. Just like me, no money either. I'm almost busted. Why don't you go home, then, the same as me? I haven't any home, said Jurgis. No home? Stranger in the city, eh? Good God, that's bad. Better come home with me. Yes, bye, Harry, that's the trick. You'll come home and have some supper with me. Awful lonesome. Nobody home. Governor gone abroad. Bubby on his honeymoon. Polly having twins. Every damn soul gone away. Enough to drive a feller to drink, I say. Only old Ham standing by, passing plates. Damn if we can't eat like that, no, sir. The club for me every time, my boy, I say. But then they won't let me sleep there. Governor's orders, by Harry, home every night, sir. Ever hear anything like that? Every morning, do? I asked him. No, sir, every night, or no allowance at all, sir. That's my governor. Hard as nails, by Harry. Told Ham to watch me, too. Servants spying on me. What you think of that, my friend? A nice, quiet, good-hearted young fellow like me, and his daddy can't go to Europe and leave him in peace. Ain't that a shame, sir? And I gotta go home every evening and miss all the fun, by Harry. That's what's the matter now. That's why I'm here. I had to come away and leave Kitty. Left her crying, too. What you think of that, old sport? Let me go, kittens, says I. Come early and often. I go where duty calls me. Farewell, farewell, my own true love. Farewell, farewell, hell, my own true love. This last was a song, and the young gentleman's voice rose mournful and wailing, while he swung upon Jurgis's neck. The latter was glancing about nervously, lest someone should approach. They were still alone, however. But I came all right, continued the youngster aggressively. I can have my own way when I want it, by Harry. Freddie Jones is a hard man to handle when he gets going. No, sir, says I. By thunder, and I don't need anybody going home with me, either. What'd you take me for, eh? Think I'm drunk, don't you, hey? I know you. But I'm no more drunk than you are, kittens, says I to her. And then she says, that's true, Freddie dear. She's a smart one, is Kitty. But I'm staying in the flat, and you're going out into the cold, cold night. Put it in a poem, lovely kitty, says I. No joking, Freddie, my boy, says she. Let me call a cab now, like a good dear. But I can call my own cabs, don't you fool yourself. I know what I'm doing, you bet. Say, my friend, what you say? Will you come home and see me and have some supper? Come along, like a good fella. Don't be haughty. You're up against it, same as me. And you can understand a fella. Your heart's in the right place, by Harry. Come along, old chappie, and we'll light up the house. Have some fizz, and we'll raise hell. We will, whoop-la. As long as I'm inside the house, I can do as I please. The governor's own very orders, by God. Hip, hip. They had started down the street, arm in arm, the young man pushing Jurgis along, half-dazed. Jurgis was trying to think what to do. He knew he could not pass any crowded place with his new acquaintance without attracting attention and being stopped. It was only because of the falling snow that people who passed here did not notice anything wrong. Suddenly, therefore, Jurgis stopped. "Is it very far?" he inquired. "Not very," said the other. "Tired, are you, though? Well, we'll ride. What you say? Good, call a cab." And then, gripping Jurgis tight with one hand, the young fellow began searching his pockets with the other. "You call, O sport, and I'll pay," he suggested. "How's that, hey?" And he pulled out from somewhere a big roll of bills. It was more money than Jurgis had ever seen in his life before, and he stared at it with startled eyes. "Looks like a lot, eh?" said Master Freddy, fumbling with it. "Fool you, though, old chappie. They're all little ones. I'll be busted in 1 week more, sure thing, word of honor." and not a cent more till the first. Governor's orders. Not a cent, by Harry. Enough to set a feller crazy, it is. I sent him a cable this afternoon. That's one reason more why I'm going home. Hanging on the verge of starvation, I says, for the honor of the family. Send me some bread. Hunger will compel me to join you. Freddy. That's what I wired him by, Harry, and I mean it. I'll run away from school, big God, if he don't send me some. After this fashion, the young gentleman continued to prattle on. Meantime, Jurgis was trembling with excitement. He might grab that wad of bills and be out of sight in the darkness before the other could collect his wits. Should he do it? What better had he to hope for if he waited longer? But Jurgis had never committed a crime in his life, and now he hesitated half a second too long. Freddy got one bill loose and then stuffed the rest back into his trousers pocket. "Here, old man," he said. "You take it." He held it out, fluttering. They were in front of a saloon, and by the light of the window, Jurgis saw that it was a $100 bill. "You take it," the other repeated. "Pay the cabbie and keep the change. I got no head for business. Governor says so himself, and the governor knows. The governor's got a head for business, you bet." "All right, governor," I told him. "You run the show, and I'll take the tickets." And so he sent on Polly to watch me. And now Polly's off in the hospital having twins, and me out raising Cain. "Hello there! Hey, call him!" A cab was driving by, and Jurgis sprang and called, and it swung round to the curb. Master Freddy clambered in with some difficulty, and Jurgis had started to follow when the driver shouted, "Hi there! Get out, you!" Jurgis hesitated and was half obeying, but his companion broke out. "What's that? What's the matter with you, eh?" And the cabbie subsided, and Jurgis climbed in. Then Freddy gave a number on the Lakeshore Drive, and the carriage started away. The youngster leaned back and snuggled up to Jurgis, murmuring contentedly. In half a minute, he was sound asleep. Jurgis sat shivering, speculating as to whether he might not still be able to get hold of the roll of bills. He was afraid to try to go through his companion's pockets, however, and besides, the cabbie might be on the watch. He had the $100 safe, and he would have to be content with that. At the end of half an hour or so, the cab stopped. They were out on the waterfront, and from the east a freezing gale was blowing off the ice-bound lake. "Here we are," the cabbie called, and Jurgis awakened his companion. Master Freddy sat up with a start. "Hello," he said. "Where are we? What's this? Who are you? Hey, oh yes, sure enough, most forgot you. Old chappie, home are we? Let's see. It's cold. Yes, come along, we're home, be it ever so humble." Before them loomed an enormous granite pile set far back from the street and occupying a whole block. By the light of the driveway lamps, Jurgis could see that it had towers and huge gables like a medieval castle. He thought that the young fellow must have made a mistake. It was inconceivable to him that any person could have a home like a hotel or the city hall, but he followed in silence and they went up the long flight of steps arm in arm. "There's a button there, old sport," said Master Freddy. "Hold my arm while I find her. Steady now. Oh yes, here she is. Saved!" A bell rang and in a few seconds the door was opened. A man in blue livery stood holding it and gazing before him, silent as a statue. They stood for a moment, blinking in the light. Then Jurgis felt his companion pulling, and he stepped in, and the blue automaton closed the door. Jurgis's heart was beating wildly. It was a bold thing for him to do. Into what strange, unearthly place he was venturing, he had no idea. Aladdin, entering his cave, could not have been more excited. The place where he stood was dimly lighted, but he could see a vast hall with pillars fading into the darkness above, and a great staircase opening at the far end of it. The floor was of tessellated marble, smooth as glass, and from the walls strange shapes loomed out, woven into huge portières in rich, harmonious colors or gleaming from paintings, wonderful and mysterious-looking in the half-light, purple and red and golden, like sunset glimmers in a shadowy forest. The man in livery had moved silently toward them. Master Freddy took off his hat and handed it to him. and then, letting go of Jurgis's arm, tried to get out of his overcoat. After two or three attempts, he accomplished this with the lackey's help, and meantime a second man had approached, a tall and portly personage, solemn as an executioner. He bore straight down upon Jurgis, who shrank away nervously. He seized him by the arm without a word, and started toward the door with him. Then suddenly came Master Freddy's voice. "Hamilton, my friend will remain with me." The man paused and half-released Jurgis. "Come along, old chappie," said the other, and Jurgis started toward him.
"Master Frederick!" exclaimed the man.
"See that the cabby is paid," was the other's response, and he linked his arm in Jurgis's. Jurgis was about to say, "I have the money for him," but he restrained himself. The stout man in uniform signaled to the other, who went out to the cab, while he followed Jurgis and his young master. They went down the great hall and then turned. Before them were two huge doors.
"Hamilton!" said Master Freddy.
"Well, sir," said the other.
"What's the matter with dining-room doors?"
"Nothing is the matter, sir."
"Then why don't you open them?"
The man rolled them back. Another vista lost itself in the darkness.
"Lights!"
commanded Master Freddy, and the butler pressed a button, and a flood of brilliant incandescence streamed from above, half-blinding Jurgis. He stared, and little by little he made out the great apartment, with a domed ceiling from which the light poured, and walls that were one enormous painting, nymphs and dryads dancing in a flower-strewn glade, Diana with her hounds and horses dashing headlong through a mountain streamlet, a group of maidens bathing in a forest pool, all life-size, and so real that Jurgis thought that it was some work of enchantment, that he was in a dream palace. Then his eye passed to the long table in the center of the hall, a table black as ebony and gleaming with wrought silver and gold. In the center of it was a huge carven bowl with a glistening gleam of ferns and the red and purple of rare orchids glowing from a light hidden somewhere in their midst.
"This is the dining room," observed Master Freddy. "How you like it, old sport?"
He always insisted on having an answer to his remarks, leaning over to Jurgis and smiling into his face. Jurgis liked it.
"Rummy old place to feed in all alone, though," was Freddy's comment. "Rummy's hell. What'd you think, eh?"
Then another idea occurred to him, and he went on without waiting.
"Maybe you never saw anything like this before, eh, old chappie?"
"No," said Jurgis.
"Come from country, maybe, eh?"
"Yes," said Jurgis.
"I thought so. Lots of folk from country never saw such a place. Governor brings them in. Free show. Regular circus. Go home, tell folks about it. Old man Jones's place. Jones the packer. Beef trust man. Made it all out of hogs, too. Damn old scoundrel. Now we see where our pennies go. Rebates and private car lines. By Harry. Bully place, though. Worth seeing. Ever hear of Jones the Packer? Hey, old chappie?"
Jurgis had started involuntarily. The other, whose sharp eyes missed nothing, demanded,
"What's the matter, eh? Heard of him?"
And Jurgis managed to stammer out, "I have worked for him in the yards."
"What?"
cried Master Freddy, with a yell.
"You? In the yards? Why, say, that's good. Shake hands on it, old man, by Harry. Governor ought to be here. Glad to see you. Great friends with the man, Governor. Labor and capital, community of interests and all that. Funny things happen in this world, don't they, old man? Hamilton, let me introduce you. Friend of the family. Old friend, the governor's, works in the yards. Come to spend the night with me, Hamilton. Have a hot time. My friend, Miss... what's your name, old chappie? Tell us your name."
"Rudkus.
Jurgis Rudkus." "My friend, Mr. Rudnose, Hamilton. Shake hands."
The stately butler bowed his head, but made not a sound. And suddenly Master Freddy pointed an eager finger at him.
"I know what's the matter with you, Hamilton. Lay you a dollar, I know. You think I'm drunk. Hey, now,
And the butler again bowed his head.
Yes, sir,
he said, at which Master Freddy hung tightly upon Yuris's neck and went into a fit of laughter.
Hamilton, you damn old scoundrel, he roared. I'll charge you for impudence, see if I don't. I'm drunk, ho, ho.
The two waited until his fit had spent itself to see what new whim would seize him.
What you want to do? He queried suddenly. You want to see the place, old chappie? Want me to play governor? Show you around? State parlors, Louis cans, Louis says. Shares cost 3,000 apiece. Tea room, Marie Antoinette. Picture of shepherds dancing. Rousdale, 23,000. Ballroom, balcony pillars. Imported, special ship, 68,000. Ceiling painted in Rome. What's the fella's name, Hamilton? Mazzatoni? Macaroni? Then this place? Silver bowl, Benvenuto Cellini. Rummy old Dago. And the organ? $30,000, sir. Start her up, Hamilton. Let Mr. Red Nose hear it. No, never mind. Clean forgot. Says he's hungry, Hamilton. Let's have some supper. Only, don't let's have it here. Come up to my place, old sport, nice and cozy. This way. Steady now, don't slip on the floor. Hamilton will have a coal spread and some fizz. Don't leave out the fizz, by Harry. We'll have some of the 1830 Madeira. You hear me, sir?
Yes, sir, said the butler. But Master Frederick, your father left orders. And Master Frederick drew himself up to a stately height.
My father's orders were left to me, and not to you, he said.
Then, clasping Jurgis tightly by the neck, he staggered out of the room. On the way, another idea occurred to him, and he asked, Any cable message for me, Hamilton?
No, sir, said the butler.
Governor must be traveling. And how's the twins, Hamilton?
They're doing well, sir.
Good, said Master Freddy, and added fervently, God bless them, the little lambs. They went up the great staircase, one step at a time. At the top of it, there gleamed at them, out of the shadows, the figure of a nymph crouching by a fountain, a figure ravishingly beautiful, the flesh warm and glowing with the hues of life. Above was a huge court with a domed roof, the various apartments opening into it. The butler had paused below but a few minutes to give orders, and then followed them. Now he pressed a button, and the hall blazed with light. He opened a door before them, and then pressed another button as they staggered into the apartment. It was fitted up as a study. In the center was a mahogany table covered with books and smoker's implements. The walls were decorated with college trophies and colors, flags, posters, photographs, and knick-knacks, tennis rackets, canoe paddles, golf clubs, and polo sticks. An enormous moose head with horns 6 feet across faced a buffalo head on the opposite wall, while bear and tiger skins covered the polished floor. There were lounging chairs and sofas, window seats covered with soft cushions of fantastic designs. There was one corner fitted in Persian fashion with a huge canopy and a jeweled lamp beneath. Beyond, a door opened upon a bedroom, and beyond that was a swimming pool of the purest marble that had cost about $40,000. Master Freddy stood for a moment or two, gazing about him. Then out of the next room, a dog emerged, a monstrous bulldog, the most hideous object that Jurgis had ever laid eyes upon. He yawned, opened a mouth like a dragon's, and he came toward the young man, wagging his tail.
"Hello, Dewey," cried his master. "Been having a snooze, old boy?" "Well, well, hello there, what's the matter?"
The dog was snarling at Jurgis.
"Why, Dewey, this is my friend, Mr. Red Nose. Old friend the governor's, Mr. Red Nose, Admiral Dewey. Shake hands. Ain't he a daisy, though? Blue ribbon at the New York show. $8,500 at a clip. How's that, hey?"
The speaker sank into one of the big armchairs, and Admiral Dewey crouched beneath it. He did not snarl again, but he never took his eyes off Jurgis. He was perfectly sober, was the Admiral. The butler had closed the door, and he stood by it, watching Jurgis every second. Now there came footsteps outside, and as he opened the door, a man in livery entered, carrying a folding table, and behind him two men with covered trays. They stood like statues while the first spread the table and set out the contents of the trays upon it. There were cold pâtés and thin slices of meat, tiny bread and butter sandwiches with the crust cut off, a bowl of sliced peaches and cream in January, the little fancy cakes pink and green and yellow and white, and half a dozen ice-cold bottles of wine.
"That's the stuff for you," cried Master Freddy exultantly as he spied them. "Come along, old chappie, move up."
And he seated himself at the table. The waiter pulled a cork, and he took the bottle and poured three glasses of its contents in succession down his throat. Then he gave a long-drawn sigh and cried again to Jurgis to seat himself. The butler held the chair at the opposite side of the table, and Jurgis thought it was to keep him out of it. But finally he understood that it was the other's intention to put it under him. And so he sat down, cautiously and mistrustingly. Master Freddy perceived that the attendants embarrassed him, and he remarked with a nod to them, "You may go." They went, all save the butler.
"You may go too, Hamilton," he said.
"Master Frederick," the man began.
"Go!" cried the youngster angrily. "Damn you! Don't you hear me?"
The man went out and closed the door. Jurgis, who was as sharp as he, observed that he took the key out of the lock in order that he might peer through the keyhole. Master Frederick turned to the table again.
"Now," he said, "go for it."
Jurgis gazed at him doubtingly.
"Eat!" cried the other. "Pile in, old chappie."
"Don't you want anything?" Jurgis asked.
"I ain't hungry," was the reply. "Only thirsty. Kitty and me had some candy. You go on."
So Jurgis began, without further parley. He ate as with two shovels, his fork in one hand and his knife in the other. When he once got started, his wolf hunger got the better of him, and he did not stop for breath until he had cleared every plate.
"Gee whiz," said the other, who had been watching him in wonder.
Then he held Jurgis the bottle. "Let's see you drink now," he said, and Jurgis took the bottle and turned it up to his mouth. And a wonderful, unearthly liquid ecstasy poured down his throat, tickling every nerve of him, thrilling him with joy. He drank the very last drop of it, and then he gave vent to a long-drawn, "Ah!"
"Good stuff, huh?" said Freddy, sympathetically.
He had leaned back in the big chair, putting his arm behind his head and gazing at Jurgis. And Jurgis gazed back at him. He was clad in spotless evening dress, was Freddy, and looked very handsome. He was a beautiful boy, with light golden hair, and the head of an Antinous. He smiled at Jurgis confidingly, and then started talking again, with his blissful insouciance. This time he talked for 10 minutes at a stretch, and in the course of the speech he told Jurgis all his family history. His big brother Charlie was in love with a guileless maiden who played the part of Little Bright Eyes in The Caliph of Kamskatka. He had been on the verge of marrying her once, only the governor had sworn to disinherit him, and had presented him with a sum that would stagger the imagination and that had staggered the virtue of Little Bright Eyes. Now Charlie had got leave from college, and had gone away in his automobile on the next best thing to a honeymoon. The governor had made threats to disinherit another of his children also, Sister Gwendolyn, who had married an Italian marquis with a string of titles and a dueling record. They lived in his chateau, or rather had, until he had taken to firing the breakfast dishes at her. Then she had cabled for help, and the old gentleman had gone over to find out what were his grace's terms. So they had left Freddy all alone, and he with less than $2,000 in his pocket. Freddy was up in arms, and meant serious business, as they would find in the end. If there was no other way of bringing them to terms, he would have his kittens wire that she was about to marry him, and see what happened then. So the cheerful youngster rattled on until he was tired out. He smiled his sweetest smile at Jurgis, and then he closed his eyes sleepily. Then he opened them again, and smiled once more, and finally closed them, and forgot to open them. For several minutes Jurgis sat perfectly motionless, watching him, and reveling in the strange sensations of the champagne. Once he stirred and the dog growled. After that, he sat almost holding his breath until after a while the door of the room opened softly and the butler came in. He walked towards Jurgis upon tiptoe, scowling at him, and Jurgis rose up and retreated, scowling back. so until he was against the wall, and then the butler came close and pointed towards the door.
"Get out of here,"
he whispered. Jurgis hesitated, giving a glance at Freddy, who was snoring softly.
"If you do, you son of a," hissed the butler, "I'll smash in your face for you before you get out of here."
And Jurgis wavered, but an instant more. He saw Admiral Dewey coming up behind the man and growling softly to back up his threats. Then he surrendered and started towards the door. They went out without a sound and down the great echoing staircase and through the dark hall. At the front door he paused, and the butler strode close to him.
"Hold up your hands," he snarled.
Jurgis took a step back, clenching his one well fist.
"What for?" he cried,
and then understanding that the fellow proposed to search him, he answered,
"I'll see you in hell first."
"Do you want to go to jail?" demanded the butler menacingly. "I'll have the police."
"Have them," roared Jurgis with fierce passion, "but you won't put your hands on me till you do. I haven't touched anything in your damned house, and I'll not have you touch me."
So the butler, who was terrified lest his young master should waken, stepped suddenly to the door and opened it.
"Get out of here," he said,
and then, as Jurgis passed through the opening, he gave him a ferocious kick that sent him down the great stone steps at a run and landed him sprawling in the snow at the bottom.
Chapter 25. Jurgis got up, wild with rage, but the door was shut and the great castle was dark and impregnable. Then the icy teeth of the blast bit into him, and he turned and went away at a run. When he stopped again, it was because he was coming to frequented streets and did not wish to attract attention. In spite of that last humiliation, his heart was thumping fast with triumph. He had come out ahead on that deal. He put his hand into his trousers pocket every now and then to make sure that the precious $100 bill was still there. Yet he was in a plight, a curious and even dreadful plight when he came to realize it. He had not a single cent but that one bill, and he had to find some shelter that night. He had to change it. Jurgis spent half an hour walking and debating the problem. There was no one he could go to for help. He had to manage it all alone. To get it changed in a lodging house would be to take his life in his hands. He would almost certainly be robbed and perhaps murdered before morning. He might go to some hotel or railroad depot and ask to have it changed. But what would they think, seeing a bum like him with $100? He would probably be arrested if he tried it. And what story could he tell? On the morrow, Freddy Jones would discover his loss, and there would be a hunt for him, and he would lose his money. The only other plan he could think of was to try in a saloon. He might pay them to change it, if it could not be done otherwise. He began peering into places as he walked. He passed several as being too crowded, then finally, chancing upon one where the bartender was all alone, he gripped his hands in sudden resolution and went in.
"Can you change me a $100 bill? He demanded.
The bartender was a big husky fellow with the jaw of a prize fighter and a 3-week stubble of hair upon it. He stared at Jurgis.
"What's that you say?" he demanded.
"I said, could you change me a $100 bill?
"Where'd you get it?"
he inquired incredulously.
"Never mind," said Jurgis. "I've got it, and I want it changed. I'll pay you if you'll do it."
The other stared at him hard.
"Let me see it," he said.
"Will you change it?"
Jurgis demanded, gripping it tightly in his pocket.
"How the hell can I know if it's good or not?" retorted the bartender. "What you take me for, eh?"
Then Jurgis slowly and warily approached him. He took out the bill and fumbled it for a moment, while the man stared at him with hostile eyes across the counter. Then finally he handed it over. The other took it and began to examine it. He smoothed it between his fingers, and he held it up to the light. He turned it over and upside down and edgewise. It was new and rather stiff, and that made him dubious. Jurgis was watching him like a cat all the time.
"Humph,"
he said, finally, and gazed at the stranger, sizing him up. A ragged, ill-smelling tramp with no overcoat and one arm in a sling, and a $100 bill.
"You want to buy anything?" he demanded.
"Yes," said Jurgis. "I'll take a glass of beer."
"All right," said the other. "I'll change it."
And he put the bill in his pocket and poured Jurgis out a glass of beer and set it on the counter. Then he turned to the cash register and punched up 5 cents and began to pull money out of the drawer. Finally, he faced Jurgis, counting it out, 2 dimes, 1/4, and 50 cents.
"There,"
he said. For a second, Jurgis waited, expecting to see him turn again. My $99, he said.
What $99? Demanded the bartender.
My change, he cried. The rest of my 100.
Go on, said the bartender. You're nutty.
And Jurgis stared at him with wild eyes. For an instant, horror reigned in him, black, paralyzing, awful horror, clutching him at the heart. And then came rage and surging, blinding floods. He screamed aloud and seized the glass and hurled it at the other's head. The man ducked, and it missed him by half an inch. He rose again and faced Jurgis, who was vaulting over the bar with his one well arm, and dealt him a smashing blow in the face, hurling him backward upon the floor. Then, as Jurgis scrambled to his feet again and started round the counter after him, he shouted at the top of his voice,
"Help! Help!"
Jurgis seized the bottle off the counter as he ran, and as the bartender made a leap, he hurled the missile at him with all his force. It just grazed his head and shivered into a thousand pieces against the post of the door. Then Jurgis started back, rushing at the man again in the middle of the room. This time, in his blind frenzy, he came without a bottle, and that was all the bartender wanted. He met him halfway and floored him with a sledgehammer drive between the eyes. An instant later, the screen doors flew open and two men rushed in. Just as Jurgis was getting to his feet again, foaming at the mouth with rage and trying to tear his broken arm out of its bandages.
"Look out!" shouted the bartender. "He's got a knife!"
Then, seeing that the two were disposed to join in the fray, he made another rush at Jurgis and knocked aside his feeble defense and sent him tumbling again. And the three flung themselves upon him, rolling and kicking about the place. A second later, a policeman dashed in, and the bartender yelled once more, "Look out for his knife!" Jurgis had fought himself half to his knees when the policeman made a leap at him and cracked him across the face with his club. Though the blow staggered him, the wild beast frenzy still blazed in him, and he got to his feet, lunging into the air. Then again the club descended, full upon his head, and he dropped like a log to the floor. The policeman crouched over him, clutching his stick, waiting for him to try to rise again. In meantime, the barkeeper got up and put his hand to his head.
"Christ," he said. "I thought I was done for that time. Did he cut me?"
"Don't see anything, Jake," said the policeman. "What's the matter with him?"
"Just crazy drunk," said the other.
"A lame duck, too. But he most got me under the bar. You better call the wagon, Billy."
"Nah," said the officer. "He's got no more fight in him, I guess, and he's only got a block to go."
He twisted his hand in Jurgis's collar and jerked at him.
"Get up here, you," he commanded. But Jurgis did not move, and the bartender went behind the bar and, after stowing the $100 bill away in a safe hiding place, came and poured a glass of water over Jurgis.
Then, as the latter began to moan feebly, the policeman got him to his feet and dragged him out of the place. The station house was just around the corner, and so in a few minutes Jurgis was in a cell. He spent half the night lying unconscious in the balance, moaning in torment, with a blinding headache and a racking thirst. Now and then he cried aloud for a drink of water, but there was no one to hear him. There were others in that same station house with split heads and a fever. There were hundreds of them in the great city, and tens of thousands of them in the great land, and there was no one to hear any of them. In the morning, Jurgis was given a cup of water and a piece of bread and then hustled into a patrol wagon and driven to the nearest police court. He sat in the pen with a score of others until his turn came. The bartender, who proved to be a well-known bruiser, was called to the stand. He took the oath and told his story. The prisoner had come into his saloon after midnight, fighting drunk, and had ordered a glass of beer and tendered a dollar bill in payment. He had been given 95 cents change and had demanded $99 more, and before the plaintiff could even answer, had hurled the glass at him and then attacked him with a bottle of bitters and nearly wrecked the place. Then the prisoner was sworn, a forlorn object, haggard and unshorn, with an arm done up in a filthy bandage, a cheek and a head cut and bloody, and one eye purplish-black and entirely closed.
"What have you to say for yourself?" queried the magistrate.
"Your Honor," said Jurgis, "I went into his place and asked the man if he could change me $100 bill, and he said he would if I bought a drink. I gave him the bill, and then he wouldn't give me the change."
The magistrate was staring at him in perplexity.
"You gave him $100 bill? He exclaimed.
"Yes, Your Honor," said Jurgis.
"Where did you get it?"
"A man gave it to me, Your Honor."
"A man? What man and what for?" A young man I met upon the street, Your Honor. I had been begging.
There was a titter in the courtroom. The officer who was holding Jurgis put up his hand to hide a smile, and the magistrate smiled without trying to hide it.
It is true, Your Honor, cried Jurgis passionately. You had been drinking as well as begging last night, had you not?
Inquired the magistrate.
No, Your Honor, protested Jurgis.